I'm Jim Smart, and this is Tip of the Iceberg, and welcome to everyone. And today we have a special guest. We have John Michael Dumais, and John, you've been around for a while, but I would like to, for our audience and for myself, like to know a little bit more your background, where you were born, where you grew up, your educational background, and
sure.
All that.
I'll give you the 30-second version.
All right.
Born in Southridge, Massachusetts. Came up to Keene when I was 1 year old and lived here, was raised here.
Oh, were you?
Yep. Left for 20 years, came back. And
you went to Keene High and
Keene
all
High,
that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Then I went to Harvard.
Oh.
I lived in Massachusetts and Virginia for...
And what did you major in at Harvard?
Psychology and social relations.
Oh, haha.
Yep, yep.
And after that?
After that, I was in Massachusetts for a number of years and then Virginia for a number of years.
Uh-huh.
And then I moved back up here in 2001, did a lot of nonprofit work, met Gerhard, in fact, with the Monadnock Freedom Forum back in 2003 when a lot of us were trying to stop the drumbeat to war in Iraq.
Yeah.
And I've been involved in educational nonprofits, worked for Parent Information Center in Concord for a number of years. Then I, over the last number of years, helped to end the death penalty in New Hampshire with the Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. So we did that in 2019. So.
And you were also choir director of the Unitarian Church for a year, weren't you?
I was, in fact, yes.
Yeah, so where did the music background come from?
Well, I was involved in music throughout high school and college. A cappella in college was part of an a cappella group.
Uh-huh.
And I still sing, you know, now and again and
do
music still.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's an important part. So it got me through.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, that's a very impressive background, yes. And so anyhow, today, John Michael is here to discuss and explain, partially to me too, certainly, about the coronavirus, which we hear about every day on television, and how it is going up or down according to whatever day or week we're talking about. And it seems, if you listen to regular television, that things are getting a little worse right at the moment because figures, as they count them, are going up. And so John Michael wrote a letter about a month or so ago questioning all this and suggesting that, first of all, that there's a possible other solution, just medically solution, by a long-winded name for a drug called hydroxychloroquine. And I have now put it on the board here so the audience can try to learn it. It is, I think, runs, 21 letters or something if we spill it all out.
Isn't it great?
And so you can see, it's easier to learn if you have it three words. Hydroxy, which everyone can remember and learn. Chloro is the second word. So you can remember that, hydroxychloro, and then quin, or quine, quin, hydroxychloroquine. It's all very simple, right?
HCQ for short.
Yeah.
People don't want to bother with that.
Yeah, you go, or HCQ. And if you can remember that too, you can go around citing HCQ and be informed. John... So you claim that this is maybe not as effective, but it's fairly effective. Is that right, as a medicine for the COVID disease?
So here's what I know. First of all, I'm not a doctor.
Okay.
And I'm not a scientist.
You are a PhD, though.
No, I'm not a PhD.
Yeah,
no.
You're an AB.
I'm just a regular BA. I'm just a citizen agitator. How's that?
Okay.
But I do listen to a lot of doctors,
uh-huh.
and I do read a lot of research. And there are plenty of peer-reviewed studies that show hydroxychloroquine within the first 5 days of symptom onset is an extraordinarily effective medicine. Now, it's typically taken with zinc and azithromycin, which is a antibacterial. There are lots of other things, by the way, that are being used, not just HCQ, but intravenous vitamin C, interferon. You know, there's a ivermectin with doxycycline and zinc. There's a ton of things that are being used. Right now, I know of about 80 peer-reviewed studies that show the effectiveness of HCQ for early onset. Now, it's not as effective for later on. And when people hear about the studies that show hydroxychloroquine didn't work, almost to a study, it was all late stage COVID where they were giving the hydroxychloroquine to people. Or they were giving huge amounts that ended up being toxic. That's a whole nother conversation. I actually have done a tremendous amount of research, and I have a 150-page book that's currently in development on this whole topic, not just HCQ, but the whole pandemic.
So if someone took HCQ, then you're saying it. What kind of percent would you have of being cured of?
Well, it's the people who are basically would be taking it would be people who are symptomatic, right? Now we know that about 80% of people are never even going to be symptomatic or are only going to have mild symptoms.
Yeah.
But in terms of what we know right now, the evidence shows that it can reduce morbidity by 50% or more if given in time.
Yeah.
So it's huge in terms of how it can reduce. Now, we know that for the general population, there's only 0.25% that dies from this, and that's with a great amount of suppression of hydroxychloroquine. Now, I originally got interested in this because President Trump came out and said, well, hey, you know, this might be a thing, hydroxychloroquine. And immediately the press was like, nah, he's full of it, right?
Yeah.
So I went doing research. I'm like, well, is there anything to hydroxychloroquine? I discovered doctors in the U.S., doctors in France, doctors around the world, came across a survey of 33,700 doctors in May. 55% of them were using HCQ, and it was rated the highest of all treatments. Why is it then that in the United States it's all of a sudden a pariah medicine that's killing people? The evidence wasn't lining up with the official narrative.
So as a medicine, then, what was its original purpose?
Well, it's been used for over 60 years, and as you probably know, it's most famous as an anti-malarial drug.
No, I didn't know that.
And it's also used prophylactically in Africa, especially. It's available over the counter in Africa.
Oh.
And Africa has a very low rate of COVID deaths, and one wonders whether there's a relationship there.
Usually Africa's high for
exactly. Like, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So there's some, you know, questioning minds want to know. And I'm, you know, I ask people not to take my word for it, to go do their own research. But I have a document. If people want to get in touch with me, they can get in touch with me, and I can give you that link later if you want to have it added to your...
Okay. Could you just cite it right now?
Sure, I can. It's a tiny.cc/pandemic-heterodoxy, all one word, pandemic-heterodoxy. All one word. And that will take them to an online folder of mine, and you can look in the folder. I've got a PDF. People can download it.
But is this .com or?
No, it's tiny.cc.
Tiny.cc.
/pandemic-heterodoxy, and that brings you right to the folder.
Okay.
And so I have several other documents in there, including a couple of radio shows that I've been on recently in Keene. People can listen and make up their own minds. You know, do the research. I did the research. I spent maybe 1,000 hours right now so far doing research.
How did you start this research? I mean, you don't have, you know, as a historian, I would have no idea where to be. Not that I'm going to, but wanted to, you know. How do you begin with it?
Well, you have to be willing to look in places that other people don't want to go.
Yeah, because, I'm used to that.
Because as you well know, there's such a thing called censorship, and I call it the censorship industrial complex, just because it's a very huge thing and people don't appreciate it.
Right.
But you know pretty well about it. So you start to identify the sites by doing searches, and you're you know, you go on message boards and you just look around, you start shaking the trees. Early on in the pandemic, you could find a lot more information, but then Google and YouTube started to shut it down. So for example, hydroxychloroquine, if you looked in Google, maybe sometime in April, you would only, for the first few pages, you'd only find bad information about hydroxychloroquine. You would never find the good information about it because they didn't want you to know, they are, didn't want you to know that it's been used for 60 years very safely. Oh, it's, you know, heart issues and this and that. Well, yes, there are some issues for a few people, but as far as HCQ goes, the issues that have been observed have been mostly in people who've been taking it for years. Yeah. And like any other drug, it can be toxic in large amounts, so you have to be careful.
Right, yeah.
But the people that were using it, there was a Dr. Zelenko in New York, there was a Dr. Didier Raoult in France who were using it with, the last one, Dr. Didier Raoult used it with over 1,000 patients with a 99 or 95% success rate with those patients. And the people who were dying were all had multiple comorbidities, were all over like 70 years old. So it was like, people are dying at life expectancy from other things that they already have, right? Even the CDC said last month that only 6% of the people who've died in the United States actually died from COVID. The other ones had an average of 2.6 comorbidities. So what, COPD, heart, you know, heart disease, diabetes.
So on. Now there is another. So it's it seems then it is fairly effective, and the figures we get don't usually take into account these comorbid aspects of the patient, of the person. Now the other aspect is the price, isn't it? And so this hydroxychloroquine is available at $1 a dose, which seems quite reasonable. Now, I wonder if we could arrange, look at that, magic. And now, here is another drug that is being offered. And it's remdesivir. Is that the way it's said? That's the way I say it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it goes for $3,000 a dose. And so, so according to general media and CDC and so on, are they promoting remdesivir more? Or as the solution? Is that
certainly as one of the solutions. Now, they did do some research early on, some studies early on, and remdesivir seems to be most famous for being able to reduce the length of the hospital stay. So that's what it seems to be doing, but it doesn't have huge impacts on a lot of different populations who have been using it. It's not like HCQ or other things that can be used. And so... Yeah, it's this is patentable, obviously.
Yeah.
It's $3,000 per course of treatment, and HCQ cannot be patented because it's, you know, been around forever. And, you know, so, yes, people can make money. Pharmaceutical companies can make money off of this one.
What company has it, you know, as a patent?
Gilead, I believe.
Oh, Gilead.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And so did President Trump have this?
I think he might have had this as part of the cocktail, but it's, it's hard to know, you know, what he was subject to in terms of advice from who, because he came out very early and said, hey, hydroxychloroquine is promising. Now, that may, you know, he's not a doctor either, and Anthony Fauci quickly said, well, we don't think so, or we don't really know about that. But the truth is, back in 2005, the NIH, which Fauci's connected with, funded a study of hydroxychloroquine with SARS-CoV-1, the first version of SARS, right? And found it, now it was an in vitro study, so test tubes and petri dishes, but they found it extremely effective against SARS-CoV-1. So that they would then later say, well, we don't think there's anything to that, is disingenuous at best, and it's fraudulent or worse at worst.
Yeah.
Because there definitely was information already out there showing that there was some efficacy with an earlier strain of SARS.
So Now, so what exactly is this SARS disease? It's there's SARS 1, 2, and 3 or something.
Well, here's the question. Right? Here's the question of the hour.
What are the symptoms and how you know that?
Well, so you have there's two questions here that we have to ask, and this is another thing that got me interested early on because I first came across an article talking about the RT-PCR test, reverse transcriptase PCR protein analysis test, basically, that takes a piece of RNA, turns it into DNA, and then amplifies it to see, you know, from a sputum specimen in your cheek or your nose, and amplifies it and sees what is and tells you what's in there. So this is how people are being tested, positive or negative for SARS. But there isn't, the problem is there has never been an isolation of SARS-CoV-2. Now the researchers freely admit we've never seen a perfect isolation of the virus. Now if
of the
SARS-CoV-2 virus, it's never been perfectly isolated. So if you were
so how do they know about it?
Well, here's the question.
Yeah.
So what this it's a speculation at best, and what they're doing is they've looked at a bunch of people, they've looked at what they can see under the microscope, then they put it together using computer programs, they go, well, we think it's this, but there's never been an isolated specimen. Now, if you were to do this properly, scientifically, you would take 500 sick people, you would get specimens from them, you would look at the microscope, you know, the electron microscope for each one of those, or, you know, their specimens, and you would say, what's common among all of these? Then you would isolate what's common among all of them, and then you would say, we think it's this. Yeah, yeah. Then you would take another look at 500 other people and say, now if we say they have SARS-CoV-2, can we find the same information in these? Those studies were never done. All they did is they took a bunch of symptoms, syndrome, which is a syndrome, which is not a cause, it's symptoms, right? So it's like cough, and obviously there have been...
And so this happened in 2005, right?
Well, the original SARS,
The original SARS.
Yeah.
And it came out in the population as, what, a flu? Or what kind
well,
of...
Well, it was... SARS means sudden acute respiratory syndrome. So it was a fairly isolated outbreak, and people were getting some of the more virulent aspects of not being of hypoxia, which was not being able to breathe. And this also showed up in SARS-CoV-2. And when people were put on ventilators for the most recent SARS outbreak, it ended up being the wrong treatment because the hypoxia comes from the blood's inability to process oxygen because of something that happens to molecules in the blood itself, iron molecules and other things. And so it's more akin to cyanide poisoning that happens with SARS than it is a regular respiratory problem that you would use a ventilator for. So it turns out that ventilators, which are a very invasive process, where you make a person unconscious, you stick a tube down their throat, it killed people. We know that for a fact that the ventilators were not.
This would be the same thing as they sometimes call a pump to keep people breathing.
Keep people breathing, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Very invasive.
But it's used a lot in heart operations and things like that. Right?
It has its place, certainly.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, but if a person's blood can't absorb oxygen, super pumping oxygen in is not going to do anything for them.
Yeah. So is this COVID related to the SARS? Or what is the...
Well, it has a lot of similarities, which is why it's called SARS-CoV-2. But again, you have to ask, how did they ever isolate a virus? Uh-huh. And if you look even on the FDA label of the PCR test, it says not to be used to determine SARS-CoV-2. And they are using analogs. They're not using a SARS-CoV-2 isolate. They're using what their best guess are analogs for when they're...
Which means a similar...
Something similar. And it says so right on the FDA instructions. Yeah. The other thing is the RT-PCR test... is used by amplifying small amounts more and more and more. Now, if you keep amplifying a DNA specimen from any of us, you're going to find almost anything. And so, if you amplify 30 times, 40 times, you're going to, you're looking so finely that you're going to find bits of old colds, which are other kinds of coronaviruses, right? Many colds are caused by, not all, but many colds are caused by coronaviruses. You'll find bits of that. You may find bits of old SARS, what they're saying is SARS-CoV-2, also in your specimen from RT-PCR tests, but that doesn't tell you anything about the individual. So if you were to go get a test tomorrow, it's not going to tell you whether you're sick with it now. You might have gotten some exposure 2 months ago. Your body might have handled it fine, and you might have dead pieces of virus in there, maybe not even enough to make anybody sick. If they kept amplifying it so many times, they might find a tiny little bit. It won't tell you anything about you, but yet they're counting those as cases.
Yeah.
So they're counting cases outside of the symptomology of the syndrome of COVID-19. Yeah. They're saying, well, as we get into September and October, leaves come off the trees, and you get your seasonal respiratory illnesses. So the fact that it's going up doesn't tell us anything. And then, of course, you know, do we know what the counts of regular flu are, regular other types of respiratory diseases, or is it just blaring every single day? Oh, pandemic, death, disease.
And because that's why they are going up now, but they don't count that.
They're not counting that.
They're counting, these people aren't wearing masks.
Right.
And also, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the mask.
Sure.
Because this is another issue that John Michael has brought forth about the effectiveness or lack thereof of masks. So,
here's an interesting
blast away.
Here's an interesting piece of data that I think will blow people's mind. So CDC reported that from a group of people they looked at in July who are actively identified as cases, 85% of them had worn masks either always or some of the time. 85% of the people
who got
COVID-19, according to their judgments and their testing.
Right.
So masks do not work. Now, you can look at meta studies.
Still on the news every night, they very definitely connect it.
Of course.
They say the increase is due to lack of masks.
But the evidence does not prove, does not show that. And up until 2020, if you looked at the studies on masking, up till 2020, all of the evidence and all of the recommendations from American Journal of Medicine, from CDC, WHO, said healthy people do not need to wear masks in a community setting. Now, if you're a healthcare worker, sure, right? If you're sick, sure. But it doesn't take a doctor or PhD to say that, hey, if I put on a cloth mask, I can still breathe in and out. Virus particles are much tinier than the weave in the mask. They can still go in and out. Mm-hmm. Plus, I'm blocking good respiration. We have a mouth that doesn't get blocked for a reason, so that we can exhale and get rid of the carbon dioxide. It's proven that if you wear a mask, you're breathing in more of your own carbon dioxide. Plus, the mask gets wet. And then what happens with that wetness? It concentrates viruses and other bacteria that you're breathing out. So unless you're changing your mask every half hour and not touching your mask, by the way, you're supposed to take the mask off by the ear clip, wash your hands right away.
Yeah.
And how many people are doing
that?
Viruses can get in and out through regular cloth masks, even through medical masks. Right on the side of the box of a medical mask, it says, you know, the blue ones that you see everywhere.
Right,
it says does not work to stop COVID-19.
Yeah.
And so, you know, common sense and studies up till 2020 have said that. All of a sudden it became a political thing and that everyone needs to wear a mask. Even at the tail end of the pandemic, in Cheshire County, three people have died in all of 2020.
Yeah. Right? So I don't know whether we have time to get it. We'll get into it, but we will try work on it. So that leads to the claim, right, that pushing the masks is also an aspect of crowd control or population control. Do you go with that?
I think there are other agendas that are. There are definitely other agendas going on.
But you wouldn't. So what is the big push, though, were to get rid of COVID in these traditional ways? I mean, the way they're saying, I think Gerhard, no, I'm not sure that he does. Some people claim there's, for sure, there's an economic motive. I mean, the $3,000 a piece treatment is
right.
would be an economic motive for drug company or a bunch of drug companies, but only one drug company would get the patent, right?
Well, you could say, I think there is an economic motive that you can see operating here, but I think it's the lesser motive. I think there's a larger motive. If people go on the World Economic Forum website and look up something called the Great Reset, there's an attempt on the part of banks and financial controllers, people who go to like the Davos event in Switzerland, the Bilderberg Group and others like that. There's an attempt to do a global financial reset right now. And you notice that,
How do you know that?
It's there in black and white. They've already announced it.
They announced the agenda.
Oh, yeah. They've announced the agenda. They think that COVID-19. The World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab.
Oh yeah.
He has a book out called COVID-19, The Great Reset. You can go right on the World Economic Forum website, weforum.org, I believe. And let's just look up the Great Reset. There are plans that have been in place for many years for a point in time like this, where they basically, I mean, you know that 1.5 million businesses have gone out of business permanently in the United States already.
Because
most small businesses can't last more than a month or two without having their regular clientele.
Yeah.
Right?
And so do
people ask, why is it that, you know, Walmarts and Home Depots could be open, but not mom and pop shops.
Right. Yeah.
So there's an agenda going on, but people need to look into it. They need to do the research. The information is out there, and it's pretty readily available.
Okay. Well, I somehow think we haven't even scratched the surface of all this. And so thank you very much for coming on the show. And so we're very pleased to have had John Michael Dumais with us today. And so you can catch this program tonight, that is Thursday night, at 7 p.m., tomorrow Friday at 8:30 a.m., and 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, 3:30 a.m. on Sunday, and 6 o'clock on Monday. Thank you, and we see you again at our next show. Goodbye.